see. We're going to begin first with the 17 periods. By this point, they should just easily roll right off the tongue. So who can tell me the 17 periods? One group. Here we go. Start off with... doing much better, a lot better. As we kind of progress along, you guys are just letting them kind of flow. I don't hear a whole lot of hesitancy, which is good. I'm not sure we're going to get points for being in sync, but you know, we're going along. We're doing a lot better as we're going through. So again, each time we go through and review these periods, it's just we're building on them each time. They're coming fresher and fresher in our mind. They're coming to the front of our mind. And as you think about these periods and you start naming them off, a lot of times you're going to start thinking about the stories they'll go along with these periods. And so knowing the stories that kind of define the period, what begins the period, what ends the period, that's going to go a long way in order for you to be able to remember each one of these 17 periods. Because if you do happen to get stumped on one, all you got to do is think through the process. What started that period? What ended that period? And by remembering those stories, it's going to help you remember what the name of that period is as you progress right along. Okay? And so, with that being said, the homework assignment for Wednesday night was for you folks to remember or to study the judges. Okay, so does everyone have the confidence to go through and name off? How many judges were there? Okay, we had both numbers correct. We had 14 judges, 15 leaders all together. So, who was the first judge? Very good. Followed by? Mm-hmm. Okay, very good. Again, very good. Not quite as loud and as pronounced as the 17 periods, but again, we just introduced it, what, on Wednesday. So as we continue to go along, we're going to drill the judges. And like I said, if my goal out of this second, trying to go through the second cycle, is to go ahead and, like I said, really drill in the 17 periods, go over the Reader's Digest version, if you will, stories of each of the periods. And then also, as a bonus, I'd like to really surprise Bob when he returns and he asks you for the name of the judges. I want you guys to be able to go back and recite those judges to Bob just as easy as you do the 17 periods. So let's go back one more time just for practice sake. I'm not going to ask you to go backwards. Let's go ahead and start from the beginning. Okay, very good. I'm impressed. As we continue to go along, like I said, it's just going to get easier and easier. And as I mentioned on Wednesday evening, it's just a matter of taking 1 minute out of each day to sit there and even if you want to just read the list of them, and then just later on in the day, try and run them through your head. As you continue to do this for maybe after a couple of days, you're going to find that you're not going to need to read that list as much. And they're all going to be right there in your mind, so they're easier to remember and easier to bring to the front of your mind. So it's very important to go ahead, like I said, to learn the judges as we go through, continue through the rest of these periods. We're going to start into the kings. At this point, we're not going to expect you to remember all the kings, but as we go into that third cycle and we start to really drill into it, it's going to be important for you to remember each of those kings as well so you can associate the stories and what happened during that time period. So we left off Wednesday evening talking about Samuel being the last judge. And what happened during Samuel's time as a judge? The people came to him and asked for a... Why did they want a king? They wanted to be like everybody else. Now, the ironic part is, they weren't like anybody else. What were they? They were God's chosen people, okay? So that meant they were set apart. They were special. They were different. Not so much different than that they were odd, but different that they were God's chosen people. They had the blessings, the benefits of being God's chosen people, which put them head and shoulders above any other nation around them. But that wasn't good enough for them, was it? They wanted to be just like the Joneses who lived next door. They wanted that physical being there in front of them to lead them. Was God not there to lead them during this time? Okay, so in a sense, they weren't rejecting the judges. They weren't rejecting Samuel's judge saying, oh, you're just not good enough for us. We want. They were in a sense, and in reality, rejecting who? God. Okay, so again, they turned around and rejected the perfect king in favor of a physical king, someone that they could have there in front of them physically. They said, well, if we have someone physically in front of us, surely we're going to follow him, no questions asked. He's going to be the one for us. Did that change anything for the nation of Israel? From that point forward, were they just straight and narrow as far as their faith and obedience to God? Absolutely not. It didn't change a thing, but God granted them their wish. They turned around, and Samuel was kind of upset about this, but God said, no, go ahead and select from you a king from the tribe of Benjamin. Okay, very good. So, we have the United Kingdom. United Kingdom lasted 120 years. Who were the kings? How many kings do we have? Three kings. And who were the three kings of the United Kingdom? Okay, Saul, David, and Solomon. Very good. Okay, so three kings. It's easy to remember because they all pretty much ruled the same amount of time for 40 years each. Saul reigned for 40 years, David for 40 years, and then Solomon also for 40 years. So United Kingdom, the nation of Israel, existed as one whole being, one nation, all 12 tribes, under the rule of Saul, David, and Solomon. Okay? What were some of the key points under Saul? What happened while Saul was in reign? We have as we already pointed out, he was selected from the tribe of Benjamin. So we started out, he was selected from the tribe of Benjamin. What was the physical characteristics of Saul? What defined him?
He was...
Exactly. So when you think about it, Saul, if you were going to go out and pick a king in a carnal sense, in a physical stature sense, hands down, you're going to go pick out Saul. He was the one that stood above everybody else. I've heard other people say he was easy on the eyes. He was a person that was easy to look at and was the one that was going to be defined. If you're going to make a poster child for a king, Saul fit that description to a T. And so he was head and shoulders above everybody else, and that's immediately Samuel anointed Saul to be the king. When Saul started out, he was very humble. And that was probably one of the greater characteristics of why he was chosen to be the king. As a king, you don't want someone that's going to be haughty. You don't want someone that's going to be arrogant. You don't want someone that's going to be proud. You want someone that's going to be humble. Someone that's going to listen and obey to God's commands. Someone that's going to carry out God's will. And that's very important because you're leading who? God's chosen people. So God's going to want somebody who's going to follow in his way. Someone that's going to help continue to lead that nation as God, if God was the one leading them. Okay, so again, Saul being chosen, he's very humble at first. Who were they fighting against during this time? The Philistines. Very good. So they're battling the Philistines at this time. As long as the nation of Israel was faithful and obedient to God, what did God continue to do? Gave them the victory. He continued to allow them to have dominion over their enemies. Wherever they needed, the enemies came up against them, they were given the power. Even though they might have been outnumbered, it did not matter. They were given the victory because God was with them. Very, very important. God is with them. What happened with Saul? Okay, became proud. He started to think, well, all these victories and all these great things that have been accomplished have been at whose hand? His own hand. Is this what happened? Absolutely not. Nothing Saul accomplished, nothing that Saul was able to acquire during his reign as king was at his own hand, was by his own ability, was because of his own knowledge or his own strength. Everything that was given to him by the hand of God. Exactly. And so, Saul didn't recognize that. He thought, well, look what I've done. I need to make my own decisions. I need to make my own calls. And so we see that eventually he becomes full of pride and he disobeys God's command. In what way did he disobey God's command? Okay, he offered sacrifice. What else did he do? Samuel came to him and told him, God asked me to send you forth to do what? utterly destroy the Amalekites. Okay, well, what did the Amalekites do that they needed to be utterly destroyed? What was the point of that? Was God just that vengeful? What did the Amalekites do? Okay, as the nation of Israel was making their move from Egypt to the Promised Land, what did the Amalekites do? They came through and they did what? They took advantage of the nation of Israel. They took advantage and overpowered them. And in doing so, God remembered their actions. So here we are, we're several years removed from the incident. Has God forgotten? Absolutely not. God's now turned around. He has Saul in position as king. Saul has his army. They have the ability. God's going to send them forth to give them the victory. They go through to battle against the Amalekites. And what happens to the Amalekites? Did they win the victory over the Amalekites? Yes. Without a doubt, they had the victory just handed over to them once again. Now, what was the issue when they were returning? Okay, exactly. They started out, Samuel received specific instructions from God. Those instructions were given directly over to Saul. Instructions were to go and utterly destroy Amalekites, to kill King Amalek, to kill all of his belongings, the sheep, the oxen, the women, the children, the infants, everything. Blot out the existence of that nation for what they had done against God's chosen people. But he had not done that. He turned around, he went, and he destroyed the nation, but he kept the king. And then he allowed his men to turn around and convince him to do what? To bring back the best of the flocks, the choicest of what was there. And in their minds, they convinced themselves this was a good thing to do, because why destroy these great things? They weren't looking to really keep them for themselves, but they wanted to bring them back and to do what? They were going to go sacrifice them to God. Okay? And was that what God asked for? Is that what God commanded? Absolutely not. He only asked for simple obedience, to follow his command, and to offer to go out and utterly destroy. And so we see where Samuel comes out and he asks Saul, what's that I hear? It's the bleeding of sheep. Okay, well, if you're coming back from utterly destroying a nation, and utterly destroying in the sense that everything was blotted out, should they be hearing any bleeding of sheep? No. Okay. And so we see where Samuel goes on to rebuke Saul for his actions and tells him that God would much rather the obedience rather than the offer of sacrifice. Even though these were indeed the choicest of the land that they overtook, he was asking for simple obedience. That's all he wanted. So because he didn't utterly destroy the Amalekites, God removed the kingdom from Saul. Now, did that come to a direct end right there? God, no. Saul continued to carry out the quote-unquote physical kingdom as he went through the rest of his years. But was God with him? No. God had removed himself, his blessings from Saul. And because of that, we see that Saul didn't go out and have the great battle victories. He didn't accomplish what he had set out to do as he did when he was his earlier years as a humble servant of God. Instead, he was just pretty much like the other kings around them. So here we see that without God's blessings, they have become just like the other kings around them. Just what they wanted. We want a king just like everybody else. But without God being with them, they were just that. And so we see, again, where God removed the kingdom from Saul. So now, it wasn't so much that even Saul was no longer going to be able to be king. Anybody from within his lineage could no longer be king. Which brings us to David. David replaced Saul as king. But how were we introduced to David? He's as a very young boy. He's selected from the tribe of Judah. Remember? They go out, select from all the sons of Jesse. Jesse is the son of Obed. Obed is the son of Boaz and Ruth. Okay, so remember last time we talked about the story of Ruth, who fits right there with the period of the judges, not so much that she is a judge, but also the book of Ruth tells us again of the peace that existed during the time of the judges, but also helps us to understand that the lineage of King David still came through the story of Ruth. So again, David selected from the tribe of Judah. David was a man after God's own heart. Okay? He wasn't so much like Saul that he was big strapping feller, ideal to look at as a king, but God saw him as the more important part. He was a man after God's own heart. And really, truly, as an individual who's going to be leading God's kingdom, that's what you're looking for. That's the characteristic that needs to stand out first and foremost, and the ability of an individual to lead God's kingdom. His early triumph as a child was against Goliath, okay? Goliath being one of the Philistines, okay? Now remember, who else was fighting against the Philistines? It was Saul. And again, Saul's victory really truly came at the hand of David, because remember, the army was out, and Goliath kept coming out day after day and taunting the army, saying, send your men out, send them out, I'll take them on. And every day they would back down, they cower away, until one day a young child, David, comes out. He wasn't able to carry the sword or the shield of the king, but he had the determination and the faith that God would deliver the victory if they simply just believed, obeyed, and trusted that God was with them, that they were God's chosen people. So he went out there with a rock and a slingshot and took down the mighty Goliath that taunted the army of Saul. He continued to train under the rule of Saul, even though he had already been anointed to be the next king. Saul, as we already pointed out, carried out the rest of his tenure as king, as a physical king, but God had already removed his blessings from Saul and passed them on and anointed David to be the next king. What are some of the stories we can read of during the time of Saul finishing out the rest of his reign and David continued to grow and develop into the next king? What were some of the things we learn of? What happened? Okay. Okay. Exactly. Saul, again, once he learned that David was the one to replace him, he didn't really take that to heart too well. And like I said, he became really good friends and companions with Jonathan. They both continued to grow and develop together. But David, outside of the fact that Saul continued to try and attack him, put him to death, did David ever retaliate? Did he have opportunity? Opportunity was presented time and time again. But David still had the respect for Saul as the king. And he still recognized that he was, at one time, appointed by God. So he recognized that and respected him because of that. And so even though he had the opportunity, even though Saul time and time again tried to take the life of David, David never once retaliated, even though he had the opportunity, never retaliated by trying to take the life of Saul. It was a great example of faith. Bar none, you're probably going to have a hard time finding a great example of faith, greater example of faith in the scriptures than looking at David. But David is a man, and man is prone to sin, okay? Even though he's a man after God's own heart, he was a great example of faith, he was still a man and committed to sin. What was the sin that most stands out when we think about David? Same with Bathsheba, okay? So here we have David, his army's out fighting, but he's still back at his castle. He's still in his home. And he's out one evening, he looks out and he sees a beautiful woman being a man. Instead of allowing his heart and his understanding of God's faith to turn around and keep him from participating in that sin, he allows himself to fall into that sin, the entrapment of that sin. And because of that, we see the result. But it's not to say that David didn't turn around after he was essentially called out by Nathan. Nathan came to him and presented a story. The story of a man who had what? One sheep. Okay? But there was also another individual who had many sheep. And when that man was called upon to kill one of the sheep to provide a meal for someone passing through, did the man take from one of his bountiful plenty? He went and he stole the what? The one sheep. Okay? Now, as we go through and the story starts to sink in a little bit more and more, we saw what David's reaction was to the story. He's like, well, how could this be? Why would this happen? That man needs to pay for what he's done. Okay? But it hadn't really clicked in David's mind that who was he talking about? Who was Nathan talking about? Nathan was talking about David. And once David realized that condition, what did he do? Did his heart harden and turn against God like Saul? Immediately he fell. And he repented to God. And we can read in the scriptures of his Psalms where he goes and talks about his penitence. And David, again, turned his heart back towards God and went on to serve many faithful years under God's rule, serving the nation of Israel. One of the other stories, and again, time is not going to allow us to go through each and every example during this period, but one of the stories that's always impressed me during this time period was the story of Uzzah. Now, this is also still during the time, the reign of David. David was going to go ahead and bring the ark back, and in doing so, at this time, did they do it according to what God had prescribed as a way to move? No, they were just so happy that they had victories, God was with them, they were joyous, and when they were moving this ark, they were doing it with song and dance, and they were doing everything except for the way God had prescribed. And because of that, they're carrying it on the cart being pulled by the oxen, and what happened? Okay, it started to stumble, and Uzzah, standing near the cart, reached out to steady it. Okay? Now, any one of us in Uzzah's position probably would have done the same exact thing. He didn't do it with any type of evil intent. He wasn't doing it with the thought that, hey, here's my opportunity to really touch that ark and see if I get any type of greater knowledge, understanding, or powers because of God's presence. He didn't do that. He did it because he didn't want the Ark of Covenant, Ark of God, to fall on the ground. And so he reached out to steady it, and what happened to him? Immediately he fell dead. Now, what was David's reaction to this? He was kind of angered. He was upset. He didn't know why this was happening. Can anybody tell me why it happened? It wasn't God prescribed. If they had been moving the ark as God had laid out, if they were carrying it by the poles as God had laid out, if they were doing it as God commanded, would Uzzah have died? Absolutely not. Again, Uzzah just happened to be at the wrong spot, the wrong time. But it wasn't that he had evil intentions, but the fact of the matter is, God's command had been disobeyed, and because of that, the penalty was paid. David immediately turned around, and he was angry. He didn't know why it was happening, and a lot of anger was probably stirred up by his confusion of what happened, what went wrong. He thought he was doing the right thing, and so they set aside the ark, and they went back to it later. God established David's throne forever. Now, what does this mean? Okay, the lineage of Christ comes through the throne of David. David's lineage would be the one to produce the coming Messiah. No matter what happened, unlike Saul, who disobeyed God, and God removed the lineage of Christ. God removed the blessings from that family. And so now David's lineage will be the one to carry through the deliverance of the coming Messiah. Even though they might sin, the throne would not be removed. What did God say would happen? If they were to sin, they would be rebuked by the what? The rod of men. Okay? If they obeyed, they would continue to have peace, blessings, everything would be given to them if they continued to obey. But, like everything else, with being God's covenant people, it comes with blessings, and it also comes with rules, restrictions, guidelines, commands. So God's just not going to happily give away everything and not expect you to be faithful and obedient, but in doing, giving you the, making them the covenant people, they had guidelines that they lived by. Same thing with David's throne. It was going to reside forever with David and David's lineage, but if they did not continue to be obedient, they would have to pay the price for that. And then we see where David desired to build a temple for God, but he was not allowed to because he was a man of war. And so because of that, he didn't have the opportunity to build that temple, which he truly wanted to do in his heart, but God says, you're a man of war, you cannot do that. But who will? His son, Solomon, will be the one to go ahead and carry out that ability to build the temple. So, as a father, thinking about what his son can carry on as far as his lineage, carry on as far as his abilities, I think that still made David very proud to think that I'm going to still have my hand, my ability to raise up my son, teach him the ways of God, and hopefully by instilling the knowledge of faith of him in him of God, he'll be able to carry out the work that I set out to do. And that's exactly what we see. King Solomon came to God, or God came to Solomon and said, ask me what you will. Okay? Now, as a young king, most times, as a young man, is your heart always set on, I want wisdom? A lot of times you want what? Something physical. You want great strength. You want respect from others. You want all this stuff. But Solomon turned around and asked God for wisdom. Now, what was God's response to this? Exactly. God was so impressed by the attitude of Solomon that not only did he give him wisdom, he gave him wisdom above anybody of that day. Probably anybody that's ever come along since. God gave him wisdom beyond all measure. And not only did he give him the wisdom, he gave him riches, he gave him honor, he gave him peace. All this was given to him, again, as long as he was faithful to God. God gives blessings, but a lot of times, every time God gives a blessing, he also has command to go along with it. He expects our faith and our obedience. So God was impressed with his response for wisdom. He gave him riches, honor, and peace. And Solomon went ahead and built that temple, just as David had set out to do, but was promised that Solomon would be able to build that temple. He built the temple. The nation of Israel at this point was at its peak. They had riches, they had honor, they had peace. All this was made available because they were what? Obedient to God. They're faithful to God's command. And because of that, God greatly blessed them. They had all this because of their obedience in God. Now, what happened to Solomon? Okay. He began to look outside of God. Now, what helped him convince him to look outside of God? What did he have? 700 wives and princesses and 300 concubines. Now, we talked about when Bob was talking about Jacob and the issues he had with just having the two wives and the wives' handmaids. How much trouble, how much strife that created. And that's just four women. Now, I'm sure each one of you men here can think about the influence that your wife has on your life and what she's able to help you to do and help you to accomplish and what way she helps to steer you when steering is necessary. Now, let's go ahead and multiply that times 1,000. Words escape me. I mean, where do you even begin? How do you handle dealing with 700 wives, princesses, and then on top of that, an additional 300 concubines? Exactly. So, Solomon, trying to control and appease each of his wives as concubines, turned around and did what? Were these wives and concubines, were they of the nation of Israel? Where did he find these? Okay, exactly. He figured, well, what's the best way to go ahead and make good policies with other countries by going ahead and taking their women as my wives? Now, had God not already given a specific command that they were not to take wives from other nations? And what reason was that? Because God thought that the nation of Israel had the prettiest women? What was the reason? Because he knew that the nation of Israel, if they intermarried, those wives, even just one of them, would have such an influence over the men of Israel, it would do nothing but become a stumbling block. It would be nothing except for a hurdle for them to turn away from God and start serving idols. The wives turned his heart away from God, and he began to build temples for his wives, idols. So it wasn't just one idol, because it wasn't just one wife. All these wives each had their own idol because they're all from foreign lands. Each one has their own specific idol that they worship. And again, Solomon, trying to be the great husband that he is, turns around and builds temples. And his heart is now focusing on serving who? Certainly wasn't God at this point. And how do you build so many temples unless you have laborers and laborers and materials, and materials cost money? And so Solomon began to what? Tax the people. You can't have all this stuff going on without having a pretty good budget, operating budget to work from. And so he's taxing the people, and then the people become overly burdened with taxes. Now, during his time, Solomon wrote Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, and also the Songs of Solomon. But because of his actions, it led us to the next time period, which is the divided kingdom. So we leave off the United Kingdom with ending with Saul, David, and leaving off with Solomon. Solomon followed up by his son, Rehoboam, okay? Now, the people are already greatly taxed. They're already burdened by all these taxes. Rehoboam takes the throne, and he goes to the people to see what they can do to serve him. And what did they say? What was their response back to Rehoboam? If you'll lower the taxes, if you'll take some of these burdens off of us, we'll gladly serve you. No questions asked, we'll gladly serve you. What was Rehoboam's response? What did he do? He went back and he talked to the elders who also served underneath his father, and the elders told Rehoboam, what advice did they give him? To do just that, to help relieve them of some of these burdens, these taxes they're facing. They realized what the nation of Israel was going through underneath all these taxes. They realized that Solomon wasn't exactly leading the people as he first set out to do, and so he said, relieve them of those taxes. They'll surely follow you. And then, was that the only advice he took? Who else did he talk to? He talked to the other younger men of his age, went to them and asked them, well, what do you guys think I should do? Now, here we have the elders who experienced a lot more experience, a lot more knowledge. They've seen things come and go throughout their lifetime. And then he turns around and asks the people of his age, and he says, well, what should I do? And what was their response? Don't let them push you around. You really need to establish yourself as a king. Take this opportunity to show them who's boss. And so he goes back to the people and says, you thought my dad was bad? You thought my dad was really pressuring you? You've not seen anything yet. I'm going to tax you even harder. I'm going to push you even harder. And what was the result of that? The kingdom split into two. So now we have the divided kingdom. Now, when you think about the land, it's kind of long and skinny, tall. Now, how do you think it divided? Divided into north and south, okay? So we have the nation of Israel was the 10 tribes up in the north. It retained the name Israel because it was the majority of the nation. And then we have Judah made up the southern portion. It was left of the remaining two tribes. The United Kingdom lasted for 200 years. And how do we describe the kingdom of Israel? Now remember, kingdom of Israel is the one that's up to the north, who was led by who? Jeroboam, okay? Jeroboam established a new system of worship so his subjects would not have to return to Jerusalem. Because if you turn around and you separate yourself from the southern kingdom, you separate yourself from people in the south, what do you not want your people doing? You don't want them heading south anymore. You want to stay in your kingdom because they're your people. They're your subjects. And so, in his mind, the best way to do this was to prevent them from going to Jerusalem was to establish his own system of worship. Now, this new system of worship, was it prescribed or authorized by God? Okay. Did this new system of worship focus solely on God? No. He created new feast days, system of worship, new gods. All this to keep his people from going down and serving God in Jerusalem, keep them from going into the southern kingdom. As a result, now remember, Israel already had trouble with following idols. They already had trouble focusing solely on God and serving God alone. And so now that you have a new system, was this new system able to really focus the people's attention on God? No. It just helped remove the blinders, allow them to see what was around them, and they were carried even further away into worship. The kingdom, by definition, was filled with nothing but wicked rulers. None of them had their hearts set on serving God. None of them did their part as far as focusing the people's attention back on God and bringing them back to the righteousness the faith that they once had. Instead, they were continuing to be one wicked ruler after one another one. The dynasty, what we call the ruling family, under the kingdom of Israel, changed 9 times. So remember, God had established the throne of David to never change. It was always going to reside with the throne of the lineage of David. Did the lineage of David reside with the nation of Israel at this point?
Mm-mm.
No, they were down in the southern kingdom. And so because of that, we see wicked rulers, deceit, unbelief in God. God's blessing is not with them. God's mercy is not upon them. And so they just, one after another, they keep changing dynasties. Now, typically when you change a dynasty from one family to another, does it happen peacefully? No. A lot of times there's a lot of turmoil. And when you're fighting amongst yourself, is it hard to focus on serving God? It's hard to do what you're supposed to do if you're doing nothing but fussing and fighting with those around you. God sent prophets to warn Israel. Did they heed the warning? No. What were they telling? What were they trying to tell the nation of Israel at this time? What were they telling them? They foretold of captivity. Okay, very good. He tried to warn them, if you guys don't straighten up your act, my blessings have been removed, my protection is being removed. Without God's protection, what's going to happen? A neighboring nation comes in and just takes control. So we see that they're carried away into captivity by the Assyrians in 721 BC. Okay, so now we have the nation of Israel, the nation of Judah. 721, the nation of Israel is carried away. And that leaves us with who? Judah alone. Okay, so before we get, then we see also the remnant that was left behind, they intermarried, because not only did they turn around and were they carried away, but the Assyrians turned around and filled that vacant land with outsiders. And so those foreigners and what was left over from behind from the nation of Israel started to intermarry, and that produced the Samaritans. Now, the kingdom of Judah, and then we also roll this right into Judah alone, the dynasty of the ruling family, as we already pointed out, the throne of David was established, so it never changed. Did this come without adversity? No. Again, they were a more righteous nation, but again, they were human, they were man, and so they weren't without their flaws either. They also had sins that they had committed. They had faults underneath their way of ruling. But by comparison, they were the lesser of two evils. They continued to try and serve God. There were several righteous kings in this kingdom. But as I pointed out, the lineage of David, the rule of David's lineage, was not to be removed as prescribed by God. Did this stop man from trying to stop that from happening? Absolutely not. They made several attempts on trying to blot out the existence of David's lineage. By doing that, they could go ahead and establish their own king. Idol worship continued to plague Judah. They were, again, a little more faithful to God. As we already pointed out there, between looking at comparing Israel and Judah, the lesser of two evils, but they still never fully put away their idols. They never fully focus solely on God. And so we saw as the kings continued to rise and fall under the nation of Israel or Judah, when there was a good king, what happened with idol worship? They hid it away. So no longer do they turn around and keep their idols out for everybody to see. They took that idol and maybe put it in the back room, or they put it somewhere else in the household where someone couldn't just readily, openly see it. Did that mean that they put away their idols? No, they just did it in secret. Now, when there was a bad king, what happened? Well, you might as well have a parade through the center of town because everybody was happy. They were going to have their idols, and everybody had their own form of idols. And in doing so, they continued to just grow and develop in their love for serving the idols. And this pulled away from their time and attention from serving God. As a result of all of this was a result of the influence of Solomon's wives. The nation of Israel had turned around and continually had struggled with serving God and God alone. But once we had the influx of all of Solomon's wives and all the idols that they brought along with them, it just further complicated the issue. And so we see the nation of Judah was finally carried away into captivity. Now, it wasn't all one foul swoop. It was in three waves. The nation of Babylon came along in 606, took away the first group. They came back in 597 BC, took another group of captives with them. And then finally, in 586, they took the vast majority of what was left, took them away, and destroyed the city of Jerusalem. All that was left behind were the poorest of the individuals, and even those didn't remain there in Jerusalem. After they were left behind, and they realized that they were without God's protection, and they were there left by themselves, where did they go? They all flew, or head back to where? Back to Egypt. They knew Egypt in their mind, even though they knew Egypt wasn't the promised land. That's what they were familiar with. They thought that, hey, if we go back to Egypt, we can kind of find protection and make our way there. So now we have Israel's already been carried away into captivity. I think it's 130 years later, we have the tribe or the kingdom of Judah also carried away into captivity. So we have come now to the period of captivity. During this time, we had the prophets Jeremiah, Daniel, and Ezekiel. Daniel served in the king of the, served as the court of the kings. Now, because of that, we see David's experience of the captivity through the experience of the court of the kings. We also have Ezekiel, but he lived among the common people. And so from Ezekiel's point of view, we see captivity through the eyes of the more common person. As a result, we really take the two of them together. It gives you a really good, a complete picture of what life, or what the time was like during the years of captivity. Now, there are many other stories of faith during this time. Who can give me some examples of faith that was displayed even under captivity? Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Exactly. They were called to serve God, or to serve this foreign king, but they maintained their faith in God, even though they were threatened with being thrown into the furnace, being thrown into the fire. They said, no, we're going to continue to serve our God. Then we also have Daniel. Daniel was thrown into the, all because he wanted to do what? He wanted to continue to serve God faithfully, and he did what? What was he found guilty of? Praying to God. Now, the king at this time had no intentions of wanting to do any harm to David, but the other men of the nation had turned around and plotted against Daniel. But again, even with adversity in front of him, the being presented with being put to death, Daniel never once turned away from serving God. The captivity continued under many kingdoms. We went from the Babylonians, from the Medes, and the Persians. And then we read of how Jeremiah foretold, even before captivity began, he foretold that it was going to last for 70 years. Now, when the prophets prophesy, does it usually come true? Exactly. So, after 70 years from the time that they were carried away, we see that in 536 BC, King Cyrus decreed that all captives were now free to return home. So, the captives all returned home, but not all as one large group, but in three groups. Who were they led by the first group? Zerubbabel. The priest Zerubbabel turned around and brought back the first and what would be described as the largest group home. And the purpose of their return was to rebuild the temple. Okay? Here they had the opportunity to go home, rebuild the temple. And is that what they did? They started to. The Jews, they faced problems with neighboring Samaritans. Now remember, where did Samaritans come from? That was that small remnant of the Jews who were left behind and who intermarried and became the Samaritans, a despised nation. But they did nothing but cause trouble with the Jews. And so eventually, after a year, the Jews said, hey, you know what? We gave it our best shot. We put the foundation down. We gave it our best shot. We tried to rebuild the temple of God. But they turned around and they turned away from the temple and focused on building their own homes. Was that the purpose of them coming back? Absolutely not. What should have been the first and foremost thing that they wanted to accomplish? To reestablish the temple of God, to reestablish their faith to God. But instead, they let a little bit of adversity set them aside, and they turned aside and started building their homes. And as a result, God sent two prophets, Haggai and Zechariah, were sent by God to stir up the people to finish the temple. How long had the temple set idle for? Okay, for 16 years, the temple just sat there idle, nothing being done to it. People focused on doing their building their own homes, farming, everything but doing what God had asked them to do. Then we see where Ezra led the second return in 458 BC, and his goal was to restore the worship. He also took the opportunity to urge the people to put away their foreign wives, because just like Jacob and just as Solomon, all of them with their knowledge and understanding couldn't handle having foreign wives or having the wives there to constantly wear them down. Solomon with the foreign wives and then Jacob with the multiple wives, they turned around and they did nothing but cause them to look away from God. Nehemiah, he represents the third return in 445 BC. Now, Nehemiah wasn't so much a group of people being led back, but it was initiative to build the walls of Jerusalem so that way they could have their form of protection. And they did that in just 52 days. To build, to take on that type of structure, and to do it in 52 days, do you think they did a fantastic job, or they got the job done? They got the job done. And so, as I continue on through the return of captivity, remember, we want to remember some of these important dates. Zerubbabel in 536 BC, then we have Ezra in 458 BC, and then finally Nehemiah in 445 BC. Now, we also have the book of Esther, and the story of Esther falls during this time period. And as we go into the third period, or third cycle, we'll explore that a little bit further. But the last prophet was Malachi, and he foretold of the one that would come to help prepare the way. But his writings tell us of the spiritual condition of Israel. They were going through the acts of worship. They were going through the forms of worship, the process of procedures. But where was their heart? Certainly wasn't following God. And so their hearts weren't in the worship of God, but he also foretold the one who would prepare the way. And then we also know of Amos, who foretold of a famine. Now, this wasn't going to be a famine of food or water, but it was going to be a famine in the form of no word from God. Even worse. I mean, as spiritually speaking, go without food and water might affect your spiritual or physical body, but to go without instruction and knowledge from God would utterly destroy you. And so for the years of silence, we have 400 years of God did not speak to his people. We have rise and fall of men's kingdoms. Many great kingdoms came and rose up, went out and conquered more land, built greater kingdoms. Many of men's kingdoms continue to rise and fall, but the development of the Pharisees and Sadducees, and Essenes, turn around, and this was during this time period when we had the formation of these groups. Now, towards the end of the years of silence, we have the rise of the Roman kingdom. They rise to power, and we're introduced to Herod the Great. Okay, Herod the Great is going to play a bigger part as we continue to move on into the latter periods. But we see that Herod the Great is given the kingdom of Judea. And that brings us to the end of the years of silence. So on Wednesday, we should be able to wrap up going through the remaining periods, which are the life of Christ, early church, and lesser Christians. Okay? Again, please remember to go ahead and study those judges, because I will ask you one more time. Thank you.